Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian. This is Insight Audio Podcast number 101. It's Friday, the 15th of January, 2010. And all the snow is gone, more or less, down here. So I'm very well in Reading. How are you, Rafe?
I'm doing absolutely fine, thanks, Steve. Still got quite a bit of snow here, but I'm hoping it'll all be gone on Monday by the time people are listening to this.
Ewan, you there?
I am, yes, but it looks like I'm going to be replaced by Jay Leno in the next hour.
Okay.
There's always an in-joke for those in the know with Ewan. And when Ray says he's fine, he actually means he's soldering on. He's actually poorly, but so well done for being here. But I gather all is well generally at All About Symbian. There's plenty of stories going on the front page. We're going to try and cover a few of those, and we have some brief review items and some questions to answer. Let's kick off with the Ovi Suite news, version 2.0.2.4.42, which sounds all rather technical, basically means that they've been gradually reducing the resource requirements of Ovi Suite and fixing the bugs and improving the functionality. I think it's finally got to the point, as I mentioned in the news story on the site, where it's now usable by the man in the street on most recent real-world PCs, and it probably is worth installing there. So that'll be my next install next time P Suite goes wrong on me. Have you installed this, Rafe?
Yeah, I had a quick look at this. I mean, I'd agree with you here. It sort of got a bit more mature. And really, the difference here between PC Suite and Ovi Suite, I mean, the first thing to realise is eventually Ovi Suite is going to replace PC Suite for most handsets. Indeed, with the recent phones that you'll buy, you'll find that it's Ovi Suite in the box rather than PC Suite, although they both will work on any Nokia phone at the moment. But the big thing with Ovi Suite is you sort of get the better handling of all the miscellaneous stuff. I would say it's like kind of a less modular approach. It's more integrated, so you get the music handling and the photo handling built in. And it can be synced automatically and just presents it, I think, in probably a more integrated and I would probably say a more intuitive way. And so I would actually get to the point now where Ovi Suite would probably be my recommendation for people, especially when they're looking to do kind of the management of their photos and music all in a single application. I think a lot of power users are probably still copying photos and music across manually. And if you are doing that, it's probably worth taking a quick look at Ovi Suite because it does certainly simplify matters considerably.
Yeah, it certainly helps if you've got plenty of RAM in your PC. I'm guessing that new PCs probably all come with 2 gigabytes of RAM. The Nokia Booklet 3G accepted.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the thing with the Ovi Suite, if you just use the basic functionality like the contact sync and the installing applications, the file manager, you won't have any problems on any PC. If you start doing the music or the photo stuff, that does require significantly more computer resources. But that's also the way with the kind of the PC Suite. If you chose to install Nokia Photos or Nokia Music as a separate application, which you can do with PC Suite. Of course, with Ovi Suite, it's kind of all integrated into a single hub rather than having 5 disparate Nokia applications. I mean, the fact is they are still separate applications from a technical point of view, but as far as the user's concerned, it's a single place to get everything from.
Yeah, I know you and you've been playing with all the different Nokia Suite and all the different modules. How have you been getting on?
I still find it amazing in this day of age of 2 gigabytes of RAM and masses of storage and processor speeds that, you need a higher end modern computer to be able to run the music application. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. I was quite happily playing MP3s back in a 486 SX25 that was barely breaking 75 megahertz in terms of processor speed and had a stupidly small amount of RAM. It's great that you have Moore's Law and PCs get bigger and faster and more powerful, but it's just decompressing and playing back an MP3 file, for crying out loud. It's just moving files over a USB cable into a phone into the right directories. It should not require something that has 27,516 times the power of a Sinclair Cambridge calculator.
I absolutely agree. I think the problem is not the MP3 playback or the bare bones manipulation. The problem is all the extra runtimes and code modules that get built in by the SDKs that they use. Things like .NET, I think, is the main culprit, and someone's phone's going
off. And of course, it is a lot more than just, you know, transferring files. Now, you've got all the album art, the editing of tags, playlist, the integration of the music store, and with photos we're talking about multi-megapixel images most of the time, so they are fairly resource intensive when you're building thumbnails in the background or importing them or rotating them or editing them, so they do require some power. But I mean, I'd agree with with both of you, I really would like to see this more streamlined, but this is a problem you get on every single platform. You know, it's no different to something like iTunes, which is now pretty resource hungry, especially if you're running it on Windows, and indeed the sort of the equivalent, the Microsoft device stages is, I think, in Vista and Windows 7 or ActiveSync. You know, they're all pretty resource hungry, which is probably speaks more maybe to the design of the desktop PCs rather than the devices themselves and what they're doing. But yeah, I for one would love to see an improvement just to make it easier, basically, without having to worry about it, wait around while things transfer. You know, any delay is a bad thing, basically.
Yeah. Talking of resources, Samsung, this is another news item from the site, has just announced the world's first 32 gigabyte micro SD card, a mere 2 days after I buy my very first 16 gigabyte card. So I was rather disappointed by that. If I'd waited another couple of months, I could have doubled my space. But just to put this into perspective, look, these things are minuscule. 16 gigabytes. That's my entire music collection ripped off every single CD I own comes to about 12 gigabytes. So I could fit every track I own and a couple of movies and a few TV programs and a number of podcasts and a load of miscellaneous files, all on something that's about 1 millimeter thick and about a centimeter long. I think that's just staggering. So credit to Samsung, but 32 gigabyte, that's an awful lot to fill.
I know, and the number that I always love to bring out here is, if you look at something like the original home computers, the Commodores and the ZX Spectrum in particular, the entire games library of the ZX Spectrum, every title ever published from that machine over about 15 years, only takes up a third of a gigabyte.
Which means,
you know, all the time when Steve will probably remember this, when you were saving up to try and get $4.99 to get the latest game, how times have changed, and you had to wait weeks, and you got it. Nowadays, you can carry every single game around, and still, you know, it takes up less space than one episode of Spooks or Victoria Wood's Dinner Ladies off the iPlayer.
So while these old gents reminisce about the time when bytes still mattered and we worried about kilobytes, not megabytes or gigabytes, I mean, I do think this is pretty amazing technology. One of the interesting implications of this, though, is, of course, for the devices we're seeing coming with inbuilt memory. You know, we've seen the N97 come with 32 gigabytes and other devices as well with 16, 8 gigabytes, you know, similarly on the iPhone and, you know, other competing devices. And the interesting thing is it's actually sometimes cheaper for device manufacturers to create a hidden micro SD slot within the device and use a micro SD card rather than sort of a flash RAM chip or whatever. And I think it will be interesting to see whether the result of, you know, getting up to the 32 gigabyte size, which is, I think, getting close to being good enough for most people, whether we see a switch away from devices with internal memory and back again to the card size. And there's always I'm always in two minds about it. I mean, I like having the internal memory, but having that extra device drive letter can be confusing. But I think I will certainly pick up a 32 gigabyte card when I can, although I have to admit I haven't really filled up the 16 gigabyte one I have at the moment.
Yeah.
As they say on a popular late night television here in the United Kingdom, I like on device memory, but I like micro SD. Who's it going to be? You can fill the rest in yourself, listener, because I can't manage that one.
And that's your second media in-joke of the show. If you've managed to find all three media in-jokes by the end of the podcast, you write in and claim a prize. Just to go back to that, the micro SD card, it's based on 30 nanometer technology. Just to put that into perspective, these little circuits on the chip, if you think about a millimeter, I think look at a millimeter on your ruler, and then think of something that's a tenth that size, then a tenth that size, then a tenth that size, then a tenth that size, and then a tenth that size. So you're something like 30 millionths of a millimeter. This is incredible technology.
So and, it's quite small then, Steve.
Yeah. Yeah. The scary thing is that there's a couple of fiction books out there which kind of look at what would happen if mankind had to go back to basics. And can you imagine? We've got nuclear disaster. We're all marooned on some godforsaken bit of wasteland, and somebody says, right, we've got to reinvent technology and get civilization back to where they were before. Right, task one, Mr. Spence, you can go and do the wheel. Rafe, could you do the 32 gigabyte micro SD, please? And you'd feel rather hard done by.
Other treats. I know, yeah. A wheel, is that it? Is that all I get? end of the world, had to put Civilization together, and you're putting together my skills at carpentry.
Yeah, I know, but part of the job is not only inventing the wheel, it's photographing it, which raises it to a whole new level of difficulty.
We're doomed. We're doomed, I tell you, Captain Mannering.
Also in the news, we have firmware updates for the 5800 version. Ooh. 40 with kinetic scrolling everywhere except where you actually need it, which is the application menu.
Boo.
You need, as the E75, E72 and N86 all had minor firmware updates, so do go plug them into Nokia software update or do check over the air.
Do remember to back up your phone before you do any sort of stuff like this.
You shouldn't need to, but it's always a good idea. In fact, you should be backing up regularly anyway. So
We all do, I'm sure.
Well, and the main thing is that danger these days is that you do some sort of new synchronization with a new online system and everything goes horribly wrong and all your contacts get duplicated or zapped. And you think, oh, no. And that's what's a good point to think, oh, yes, I did a backup onto my memory card last week. And you just restore. So do regular backups. Even in this day and age, they are needed.
Well, therefore, being honest, it's probably only, you know, people like us who try out new sync routines every couple of weeks just because we like to live a difficult life for everybody else. Backups sometimes seem less necessary, but I did do a firmware update the other day and it did go wrong and I did need to restore a backup, and I was very pleased I did because it saved me a couple of hours of reinstalling applications and setting up the contact sync and all that sort of stuff again. So it does happen sometimes, but in Orbi it's the first time it's ever happened to me actually having this firmware update fail in terms of restoring data. I'm not quite sure what happened. I think I bricked the device by, it was when the cat trod on the USB cable or something like that.
You always manage to blame the cat.
Well, it usually is the cat's fault.
And the thing, of course, we're not just talking about technical errors. Backup is also useful because of human nature. I mean, when we look at the size of micro SD cards, they are very easy to get lost. And unless you have backed up your machine, there's very little you can do if you accidentally drop your phone into a bucket of red wine on New Year's Day. So, Ronnie, if you're listening, I remember that story.
Moving on.
I'm going to get 10 references. Oh, you watch me.
Moving on, this afternoon, we're recording this on the Friday, prior to the day you're listening to this. I'm heading out with Oneworld and Nokia to do a series of e-learning sessions with schools in Maidenhead in Berkshire. And I know some bloggers from the Symbian ecosystem are taking part as well. So that's quite exciting. I shall be reporting back on perhaps Nokia's aims, Oneworld's aims, and how it all went. They were using Nokia N96s as their main device of choice, so that'll be interesting. I gather the N85s used for the session yesterday all went horribly wrong, so watch this space. Symbian 4 now. We have the last news item. As we record this today, Symbian have released details of Symbian 4 new user interface ideas. Rafe, what's it all about?
Right, so I'm going to try and summarize this as briefly as possible, but as is my wont, I'll probably end up waffling for a while. And what we've got here is the concept proposals that was submitted by Nokia to the UI Council and also the Feature and Road Mapping Council at the Symbian Foundation. And this is when you submit a proposal, which is what is part of Symbian 4, you have to submit it as a document. And we've had some of this documentation now being made public so that the Symbian community can comment on some of the things that are in it. And these proposals are about Direct UI and Orbit, which taken together are what make up the new UI that will be coming in Symbian 4 and will quite dramatically change what the devices actually look like. Of course, there's a lot of things going on under the hood, but at the moment we're just going to be focusing on the UI, basically to understand it, that Orbit is effectively the extensions to Qt which enable Direct UI, and Direct UI sort of encapsulates the interaction and navigation logic, if you will, that sort of makes up how it actually looks like. It describes what the UI does, and there's a contrast here in the Orbit, which is, if you like, the UI libraries, for want of a better word, is agnostic in terms of whether it's touch or non-touch. Direct UI is at the moment only for touch or hybrid devices, so what is currently S65th edition, which going forwards does suggest that we're looking at the majority of devices being touch or hybrid devices, at least ones using the future Symbian Foundation platform. That could potentially change in the future, but that's as things stand for Symbian 4, and that also applies to Symbian 3 and Symbian 2 as well. So what are the changes that we can expect to see in Symbian 4? Well, really, it's a case of simplification. At the moment, the UI in S60 5th edition, or Symbian 1, as it's also known, is really showing very much its legacy from a non-touch platform. And I'm thinking of things like the options menu down on the bottom and the rather large title bar at the top. So what we can expect to see going forward is a change to a kind of a flatter hierarchy, if you will. Rather than hanging everything off the options menu, you'll have a toolbar at the bottom with up to 4 shortcuts. And at the top, there'll be a drop-down menu in a reworked and smaller title bar. And that drop-down menu will be for secondary commands, the sort of things like settings that hangs off the options menu at the moment. So you will still have that menu, but the primary controls will be available in a toolbar at the bottom. Now, the implications of this may basically mean that you'll have to less touches on the screen, because everything will be presented straight away when you open an application for the most common tasks. There's some other important things to note. For example, there's much better support for self-hiding of the title bar and the toolbar elements. So if you think about the N97, for example, which has its automatic full screen mode in the web browser, you'll get that sort of thing running across the entire UI. You're also going to keep getting a change in the dialogues rather than popping up at the bottom. You've got 3 potential templates for dialogues, but the important thing is they float above the kind of the UI, if you like, and can be dismissed with a, you know, flick of the finger, or will auto-dismiss themselves after a certain amount of time. But you'll see, effectively, the background grey out and the dialogue present itself at the front, which, as well as looking better, should be more intuitive. There's a lot more that you can go and have a look at on the Symbian Developer Wiki if you're interested in seeing what these proposals look like. And we've included some screenshots on the website as well. That will almost certainly still be on the front page by the time you're listening to this podcast. And there are plenty of other changes, but really what this does is make the Symbian UI in Symbian 4, I think, much more in line with what we see in other competing touch UIs at the moment, like Android, like iPhone, and also to an extent Windows Mobile, and there are quite a few other touch UIs out there. In other words, rather than hanging things off menus, it will be a much flatter structure, as I say, and so the majority of the tasks you'll be able to do by just pressing the toolbar, or by doing a long press on the screen and getting a context bar up. So if you think about, for example, at the moment, emails, you have a long list of emails. In order to delete an email, you have to press the options menu, scroll up, find the right command, then delete it. In the future, you'll long press on an item and a delete command will come up. So it's, in theory, it's meant to make everything a lot more intuitive for users. It's quite hard to explain in an audio podcast, so I would recommend you go and have a look at the content that's on the site as well as on the Symbian developer wiki. And for developers, this explains how things will be changing. For users, you can get a glimpse of what future devices will look like. And with Symbian 4, we're talking about it being functionally complete by late summer this year. Hardened, that means ready for productization by the beginning of 2011. And it'll be in the first devices in Q1 2011. So there's a lot to see there. And it's quite exciting to see the future of the UI, you know, finally get its sort of first appearance, and there's plenty of food for thought. And what the Symbian Foundation really want is people's feedback on what they think about the proposal, if developers see any problems, whether users have got any comments. And in order to comment, you can go and do that on the Symbian developer forums, and I'm sure they'll be glad to hear any feedback, any comment, or any questions that you may have. So go and check it out.
Yeah, it all looked pretty slick. And talking of looking pretty slick, there was, I noticed that you and Points View there, you spotted a few clues as, for Symbian 4 in something that was released last week.
Indeed, yes. Out of the Nokia-based labs there, Gig Finder, which allows you to add in your favorite artists and also looks at the artists that you have loaded up on your music player in your 5th edition device to find venues and bands that are playing close to your location or the location that you put in the search box that you can go and listen to. And I looked at this first and went, this looks nothing like the S60 UI. What are Beta Labs playing at? And when you look at it, you go, aha. It is. It's the Symbian 4 proposed UI. It's got your menu bar in the top corner with a little drop down. It's got the button on the top right, which does your back through all the screens, title bar, 3 tooltips at the bottom. So if you want a little preview of what this is actually like in action, grab yourself Gig Finder. And Gig Finder itself it's a not bad application. I'd be interested to know where they're getting the information about the gig listings. But a quick bounce around some of my favorite locations in the entire world, it does bring up some of my favorite concert venues.
What about Edinburgh, though?
Edinburgh's not, well, let's do it now, because when it launched and I did do a search on Edinburgh, it died. It just went, there's nothing here. But looking at it a little bit more, what I think it is I think there's nothing here that we think you'll like, which is an interesting one. So let me just put Edinburgh into the venue. I'll give it, let's say, this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and see what it comes up with. I mean, this is one of these tomorrow's world moment where I get the no connection available. Please try again later. Thanks, guys. I'm trying to cover for you. But I have to say, it's a very nice and slick application. And it does show what Symbian 4 is going to be like.
The obvious question, you know, while we're waiting for it to do its stuff in the background is, you know, as a sort of UI paradigm, bearing in mind, of course, that it's a very kind of early implementation, a bit rough and ready, you know, did you think it was something that was fairly easy to use and intuitive?
Certainly, if you've used mobile portable devices before, yes, you can see where things are going and you can have a good guess. You know, there's a little bit of experimentation with the buttons. I suspect that would be the same if you had any new device. So it's certainly easy to do. I'm not that enamored of its landscape mode, I have to say. I'm running this on the X6, which I believe we're going to be coming to in a second, with a 16:9 screen. And the buttons are just too wide at the sides. It loses a huge amount of real estate putting in the title bars at the top and the right hand side. So I'd like to see a serious reworking and you know, rather than take the portrait mode and make it work in landscape, what they've done with the portrait mode is they've went back to basics. I'd like them to see them do that in landscape as well, which is go right back to basics, remembering that most of these devices are now going to be quite thin, quite narrow body. They're going to be more Ally McBeal than Rosie O'Donnell.
Yeah, well, it is interesting to note, in contrast to GigFinder, actually some of the early Symbian 4 screenshots, as well as some of the ones we've seen at Symbian 3, do noticeably reduce the size of the title bar fairly significantly. And also, rather than having the sort of, as you say, the wide landscape mode buttons that are typical of S65th edition, cut those down often so they're just a picture. And that will be variable depending on the application you're in. So I think it's interesting to see that you've picked up on that already, and that's something that's sort of already evidenced in some of the early concepts. Mm-hmm. So have we got any results back for Edinburgh yet?
We haven't, no, but we do have results for Glasgow, so I can only assume that this was written by BBC Scotland. Yeah, they've got King Tut's coming up, the Carling, and various stuff in Glasgow as well. So nice to see.
Yeah, okay. We mentioned the X6 there. Ewan has been continually trying it and reviewing it, and you can read his various reports on the site. But is there something you can rant about in 2 or 3 minutes about the X6 here, Ewan?
What, some sort of summary of what I think of the X6?
Well, either saying something nice about it or saying something nasty about it. It's up to you, really.
Oh, okay, right then.
Well, there we go. That was Ewan Spence on the X6.
On the other side, I have to say this X6 has been made to suffer rather a lot, because Ewan, as some people may know, is a bit of a Eurovision fan, and so this X6 was forced to play back 3 hours worth of Eurovision Song Contest video. So Ewan, you got that onto the device by sort of transcoding it over from somewhere else. What experience was that like, and did the video actually play back in a reasonable quality?
Indeed, yeah, this was a single 3.5 hour video file. Honestly, it was the first one that came to hand, Your Honour. No, it wasn't. I deliberately chose it. And I just dropped it into the PC suite, you know, a bit where it says drag and drop content here. Dropped it on and said, oh, would you like to convert this? And I went, yes. And then I went and had a cup of tea.
Most people
Most
people start with a 3 minute music trailer or music video or a movie trailer, Ewan. You start with a 3.5 hour Eurovision epic.
And how long did it take, and did it work? I mean,
it took about an hour and a half, I think, to do the full transcoding.
But it's pretty encouraging to see that kind of thing work, given that you only have to go back a few years, and that sort of thing was an absolute nightmare for getting things onto the device in the right format and of reasonable quality.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, if let's go, as we say, go press back on the application and look at the X6 as a whole at the moment, this is a pretty nice device. It has some problems. The cost is quite high, partly because it is only coming in the Comes with Music package at the moment. There should be a regular retail version of this available in February. Yes, it does have the capacitive screen, and we're going through the coldest period possible in the United Kingdom at the moment, which means when I'm outside, I have to take my glove off and immediately risk hypothermia to run this device, because you can't use a stylus. You have to use the galvanic skin response to get this. Construction is not bad. It's got this sort of bendy plastic back like the 5800 had, which makes you think it's a kind of a cheap device. Then you look at the front, and the front looks this sort of mirrored bonded finish that you would see in some 1980s Donald B. Pulsario car series. So there's a little band of blue at the top and bottom just to give you that bit of style. And it's the fifth edition that's given just enough so it works in touch and no more. The suspicion is that most people are working on Symbian 4 at the UI, and fifth edition is just being put in as a stopgap. The X6 is going to be an interesting footnote in Nokia's history. Yes, it's the first device with a capacitive screen, and it's the first device that I actually think sits next to something like the iPhone with a very similar set. The 5800, of course, had a resistive screen and was slightly cheaper feeling. I think this is the first one that I would be happy to put side by side on one condition. And that is Nokia fix the firmware. Every lesson that we hoped they would have learned from the N97 launch, poor applications, buggy code, incredibly low RAM, constant crashing, all the lessons that we hoped they would have learned and applied to other phones have not been learned and have not applied to other phones. The X6 at the moment is incredibly unstable, especially in the music application. Now, I loaded it up real world and with about 16 to 20 gigabytes of music. And when I came to write the review, I actually had to ask Steve if I was being fair, because a lot of the other reviews out there on the internet hadn't mentioned any of the problems that I was having with the music player. Isn't that right, Steve?
That's right. But most reviewers would just do what I would do. They'd, we'll stick a half dozen Pink Floyd albums on. Yes, they play all right. Okay, music player tick. You stuck on 15 gigabytes, I believe.
Yes. And not all of it was Eurovision music, I have to add.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank Some you. Of it was John Barrowman.
Oh, Barrowman! No, sorry, I'm doing
it! You can spot one media in-joke from Steve.
You carry on.
So the X6 is nice, and I think if Nokia do the firmware updates in this as they did with the 97 5800, it will become a good device. The problem is Nokia don't need an evolving device that will get good soon, because they've had too many of them in recent years. There's now this perception building that Nokia launch a rubbish buggy device and spend the next year releasing updated firmwares for it, so nobody buys the device. And that means Nokia won't fix the firmwares on them because nobody's got the device. And they get into this invirtuous cycle.
I would just provide a bit of a contrast to that. And say,
people, controversy.
You know, this I mean, I agree with everything that you're saying, that they're picking up this reputation, but I do think that's partly in the media bubble. I mean, the vast majority of people buying phones actually buy them, you know, a few months after their release, when they've typically had their first firmware update and are more stable. I'm not excusing what Nokia do at all, and I think this needs to be focused on internally, and there needs to be this quality control. I mean, I think I'd look at something like the N97 Mini as a second generation device, benefited a lot from the N97 going before. And it's not perfect firmware by any means. It needs some improvements on the RAM handling, for example. But by and large, it's a pretty stable and good to use device. And the X6 is sort of the opposite of that, in that it's, you know, kind of a new branch of a family. And sure, it gets some stuff from the 5800, but there's enough new in there that clearly has upset it enough.
No, I'm going to disagree with that.
The only thing I would say about RAM is that people sort of say, oh, they've made the same mistake with the N97 or whatever. And yes, that's true, but you have to bear in mind kind of the timescales for this sort of thing. You know, they may learn something with the N97, but that doesn't necessarily mean it will get applied immediately, because the specifications of the X6 and indeed devices for the next year will have already been fixed. This is something they'll be going, right, it's obviously going to be a problem. We need to make sure we have it in future devices. But for things like that, there can be a lead time of anything up to 18 months to 2 years. And it is a problem. And actually, we saw a similar thing happen with the early S63rd edition devices. And that's when the RAM sort of got bumped up from 64 to 128 megabytes. And I'm rather hoping we may see the same thing happen with the Symbian 3 devices, where for at least the, shall we say, the higher end ones will get a boost. It's interesting to note that if you don't push the devices, particularly the lower end devices, you tend not to see these problems. It is the high end devices like the X6 and the N97 that are most prevalent with these RAM problems. Anyway, sorry, Ewan, I
know this is going to get the commenters up, and I can understand what you're saying, Rafe, but this device is sold as a music phone. It has comes with music on it. The expectation is you will put a lot of music on that. Your primary application is the music application. It crashes after 20 minutes.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm not saying
somebody up there in Nokia needed to say, stop. Hammer time. Stop. We're not doing this. This can't go out. I said in the review, and I'll say it again, I carry an iPod Nano on back just in case phones crash when I go on long trips or I'm away for 2 hours. I had to get my Nano out and blow dust off this thing because the X6 was unreliable at playing music. And not because it was running millions of other applications in the background. From a cold boot to the music player, I can crash that thing in 5 minutes just by playing music.
Yeah, no,
the primary purpose of the phone fails.
And absolutely, that's what I agree with, where I was saying they need to get onto a quality control. I was trying to draw a contrast on some of the wider issues. But yes, with the X6 is really quite horrific. It's interesting. I have spoken to a couple of other people who have picked up the X6 and say they haven't spotted the same problems, which is actually a problem we're starting to see more on All About Symbian, is where you get two devices which are ostensibly exactly the same, running the same firmware, and you can't get them crashing. And I know, Steve, you've come across this same problem with the Sony Ericsson Satya, where you've got a specific bug that always has the video player crashing, which other people running exactly the same firmware haven't been able to repeat. And would certainly be interested to hear some feedback from people on how you handle that sort of thing, because obviously we can only write about what we experience ourselves. And we've had a similar thing happen with the E72 and Exchange support, which a lot of people have been complaining about. And I've been running Exchange on the E72 without any problems whatsoever. So it's part of a wider issue. But I do think in the case of the X6, you know, the experience that Ewan has just isn't acceptable. And Nokia need to be on top of things like this.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, it's the fact that I might use an application in a different way than the product managers and the people at Nokia are using it. For example, classic example, the Nokia OviStore client, they released a version for the Nokia N86. And I would launch it. I would navigate to an application in the store. I'd press in the D-pad, select it, and the application would crash. I then report that to Nokia. No, it's working fine here. I said, it's crashing here. Do I need to do a video of it? We tested, we retested it. He checked, I rechecked. Still crashing for me, wasn't crashing for him. When we actually dug down, it found out that rather than pressing the D-pad, he was scrolling to an item and using option select on the left-hand function key. He was basically using the UI in a different way to me, and that made all the difference. And the crash only happened if you use the D-pad. I think in some other cases, you press the D-pad, and rather than just select an item, it would actually drill right down into the details page for an application. So very different way of working, depending on whether you're using the left function key to select and the up and down, or whether you're using the D-pad.
Absolutely. It does illustrate the problem that you can do things in several ways, and so it's not always straightforward. And we do try and use these devices when we're reviewing them for, you know, several days, you know, a couple of weeks, so we do actually get a real experience with them. But of course, you know, you can't be completely comprehensive because everyone uses a device in slightly different ways and for different things. So that is something to bear in mind when you read the reviews and we get feedback saying you're completely wrong about something. You know, we don't out to mislead at all.
But that's true of any computer. That's true of any PDA going back to times. I mean, we, you know, the things, even when you go back and look at the early Palm 3s in the US Aerobotic 5000s, you know, you had problems because apps interact in strange ways. This isn't a new thing. This hasn't suddenly popped up in the last 2 years because phones have passed some sort of magic digital event horizon. It has always been there.
Oh, right.
And other manufacturers have been able to carry on with the growth. And certain manufacturers, and most of the ones that are using Symbian, unfortunately, seem to be slipping down.
Absolutely. Although I think part of this is down to you will see it more often as complexity increases. And I think this thing is just as prevalent on other platforms. You look at something like the Sony Xperia X2, I think it is, which, you know, has been withdrawn by a couple of UK operators, and it's just a buggy device. But equally, where you see it on some of the Samsung Windows Mobile devices, the Samsung Android devices as well, and the problems that some people are having with something like the Nexus One that Google have just come out with, and saying they can't get it to work on 3G and it's always staying on edge. And in one sense, that's just as critical a failure if you're doing something like web browsing on the move. So, you know, a lot of the attention does get focused, and doesn't excuse any of the failures, of course, but I think this is something we see more commonly in devices, and some people are quite accepting of it and just work around it, and some people, and I think this is a reasonable approach, say it's not good enough, this should be working. And it does sort of lead to the sort of questions, do you need to have better ways of tracking these kind of bugs? It's interesting to look at, for example, what Nokia's doing with MIMO, having a very open Bugzilla policy where people can go and submit bugs and follow them up. And it's interesting to see in their most recent firmware update, they've fixed some of the things, for example, an Exchange 2003 incompatibility problem. So I wonder, you know, is there scope for sort of new methodologies to help this sort of thing? It's certainly an interesting area.
Yeah, I've done several editorials or had them in note form. So thinking to myself, are these devices just getting too complicated? Have we reached the point where they're getting so complicated they you can never produce a perfectly stable, perfectly mature device and platform?
Yeah. I mean, the defect engineering, if you look at the Symbian Foundation release plans, they're using defect monitoring as a way of judging quality and stability of the platform. And it's quite apparent across all mobile platforms and indeed all sort of software that as the complexity increases, the frequency of defects tend to increase. You know, it's the ghost in the machine effect, if you will. But it's certainly something that, you know, there aren't any easy solutions. And, you know, there's some impressive bits of software out there that developers can use to sort of trace problems and do automated testing that solves many of these. And you just sometimes wish that, you know, a little bit more effective could happen on the initial device releases. So just there were a few bugs, I mean, I think people will accept, but it's when it gets over that threshold to start becoming really irritating, like crashing your music player application after 10 minutes, as Ewan's experienced, that it really gets to be a significant problem in terms of affecting how people perceive your devices.
Absolutely. And as I've already explained before, if Nokia, if you're listening, you and Rafe and myself are all available for crashing prototypes and generally ironing out these sort of things. Ewan will stress test it to high heaven.
Stress somebody to high heaven, yes.
And the clatter you heard in the middle there, I think that was just Ewan doing some drop testing on the X6. So we'll look forward to the results of that as well. A couple of brief questions before we finish. Alex FUKS, I won't attempt to say that one, says, when will N97 version 21 firmware be released? We haven't the faintest idea. I did hear a whisper on the wind that it was almost ready and then sent back for a few final tweaks. So I'm guessing a week or two.
Alex and everybody else, we're not Nokia. We don't have this magic hotline. We don't know the products that are coming up for the next 12 months. We don't have all these release schedules. We're not in the pocket of Nokia. We don't know what they're going to be doing. We're in as much of the dark as you are. And if we weren't, we would probably have signed a bit of paper that says we have to tell you that we're as much in the dark as you are.
Although we can sometimes pick up on hints and tips, as it's our job to know what's going on. But yes, there is a version 21 firmware on the way. As Steve said, there was a suggestion, I think, on one of the Twitter streams that said it had been delayed. But I would expect this out before the middle of February.
Yeah, the N97 version 20 is still pretty stable, actually. That was a particularly good release. So I don't think there's a tremendous need for them to rush it and then break it again. And the N97 Mini we talked about earlier having a pretty good stable firmware. That is its launch firmware. In fact, it was the most stable launch firmware of any Nokia device that I can remember. And I'm still using the N97 Mini to this day on my waist as I speak. And there really are just no bugs. All I would ask for is a bit more RAM. And that's a pretty stable state of affairs for a launch firmware on a Nokia S60 fifth edition smartphone. So Nokia do get it right sometimes, but we do look forward for that N97 firmware being updated. Because I think Skype in particular was something that promised months and months ago. And I think a lot of people are still clamoring for that. And I gather that the new firmware will have some of the necessary modules and place to enable Skype. Group 51 UK says, where's the Symbian tablets? Like, then I guess he's looking ahead to the rumored Apple tablet coming at the end of the month. I would argue the Samsung i910 is probably a Symbian tablet. Ewan, any thoughts on this?
I don't know, Group 51 UK. I'm in as much of the dark as you are.
Thank you, Ewan.
You said that already.
I think the answer to this is that at the moment Symbian is primarily focused on phones, and you will get tablet-like phone devices, as Steve's already mentioned. But I wouldn't necessarily expect at this point in time to see, you know, tablet-esque devices in the sense that most people think of tablets. That may come in the future. I think once Symbian 4 is out of the way, the full open sourcing of it, there's a possibility for all sorts of things. But I wouldn't expect it as a direct competitor to things like the Microsoft Courier or the HP Windows 7 tablet or the rumored Apple tablet or some of the Android tablets that, again, are rumored coming out immediately. Everyone has their own view on tablets. At the moment, it's still very early days. Is it possible to do it? Absolutely, but I think you'd probably need to look at redesigning the UI in order to make it as effective as possible. I wouldn't expect a tablet-specific device. More tablet-like phones, absolutely, we'll be seeing more of those this year.
I think the problem here is the tablet form factor is not proven. Yes, there are rumors of one coming out of America, but you have to remember that that is going to feed into an ecosystem that's already built around a tablet, the iPhone. So if you take the iPhone and just multiply the screen size up, it should handle tablet-y stuff quite well, and it already has a massive closed-off, locked-in ecosystem, similar to what we talked about in Insight number 100 last week. The Symbian devices aren't especially tablet suited at the moment, certainly in 5th edition, and Symbian 3 and Symbian 4 may or may not be able to do it, but the user interface is not built for a tablet. And even if you got Symbian's foundation and it's the ability to do a tablet stuff, which is possible, you still need a manufacturer to decide to build one and bring one to market in a decent quality that will make an impact. And tablets have been around for years. I remember picking up an old Compaq TC1000, admittedly Windows XP tablet edition based machine, back in 2001. And, you know, they didn't really take off then. Tablets are rather like an engine with the choke not pulled out yet in this weather. They're all you know, they're getting in some niche markets very well, but not one of them zooming away. A lot of people think Apple will manage it, and with their brand name and their system, they may well have that initial push and get a million units out and get them sold. It's whether that creates a new demand for this type of platform. And honestly, I don't think that there is a big enough market for slates out there to sell more than 2 or 3 million a year. You spread that out over 10 or 15 manufacturers, and it is not viable, and none of them will get involved.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think this all really ties into the future of mobile devices and where are they going. And I can't really see the majority of people carrying around a tablet-like device. Would I use one personally? Yeah, I think I probably would because, you know, as a high-end tech adopter geek, that sort of thing maybe appeals as a couch surfing device. But I think looking at sort of phones in general in the mass market, I still really a believer in we're going to see hybrid devices, which in the next few years are going to remain sort of phone size and will break down into two broad categories, kind of with a keyboard and without a keyboard. And I actually expect the ones without a keyboard or at least with more hardware controls to dominate over the ones which are, relatively speaking, just slate with one or two control buttons. Keyboards in various forms, but for example, when I say a hybrid device, so things like D-pads will get sort of reintroduced. As I say, personally, tablets, yes, but I'm yet to be convinced by them as a big mass market thing. But you never know. It'll be an interesting area to watch.
Yeah, good. Thanks for the question there, Group 51 UK. And if you've got a question, do send it in by email or to a Twitter account, Steve Litchfield, Rafe Blandford, or Ewan. I'm sure you'll work out the spelling if you can't find us initially. But for now, though, it's goodbye from me, Steve Litchfield.
Goodbye from me, Rafe Blandford.
And it's goodbye from me, Bob Carroll-Rees.